From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is Here and Now. It's back to the drawing board for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She's trying to put together a bipartisan select committee to investigate the January 6th insurrection. Earlier this week, Pelosi rejected the appointments of two Republicans, Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio and Jim Banks of Indiana. They were both nominated by House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. Here's Pelosi.
They have made statements and taken actions that I think would impact the integrity of the commission, of the committee, the work of the committee.
McCarthy called the move a, quote, egregious abuse of power and threatened to pull all five of his nominees from the committee.
Well, it's Friday, so let's add that subject to our weekly politics roundtable. This week we have Maya King, politics reporter for Politico. Hi, Maya.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and Margaret Tolov, managing editor for politics at Axios. Margaret, welcome to you as always.
Hi, Robin. Great to be with you.
And we just heard Speaker Pelosi say that Republicans Jim Jordan and Banks, Jim Banks, have statements and actions that would impact the work of the committee. She's now considering adding outspoken Republican Trump critics, including Congressman Adam Kinzinger. Margaret, start with you. What's the talk about this? We also hear people saying maybe she should have kept a firebrand like Jim Jordan on the committee so people could see what they say is his disregard for January 6th. What's the chess play here?
I think Pelosi just took a look at kind of the pregame that Representatives Jordan and Banks were sharing, seeking sort of publicly to invalidate the premise of the committee or the scope of their work to begin with, or to say that the real thing that should be investigated is Pelosi, or that somehow, you know, Democrats were responsible for supporters of former President Trump storming the Capitol in a violent way that led to death. So I think her decision at that point just reflected her view that the hearing, the committee would turn into a circus, and that she already had one Republican on the committee because she had appointed that Republican. That's Liz Cheney from Wyoming. And she just pulled the plug on it and said, the ball's in your court. We know what McCarthy did next. And so ever since then, the question has been, could she take those five slots that would have been McCarthy's to appoint, that he's now said, no, I'm not going to appoint anyone, and fill those with other Republicans, fill any from, you know, one to five of the, well, I guess it's not, she'd remove two. Mm-hmm. This is, I'm getting in the weeds now, but yes, there are five mm-hmm. spots now that she could fill. Or could she just, does she not need to do any of that? Or could she do something in the middle? Like, for practical purposes, I'm not sure that it matters. She still has a committee. There is still a Republican on the committee, whether Republicans think Liz Cheney counts or not. And the committee still has subpoena power because the Democrats are in control of the House. Will it be viewed as partisan by Republicans? Yes. Would it have been viewed as partisan by Republicans anyway, even if those five Republicans that McCarthy pulled had served? Yes. And does Pelosi have the ability to unearth or put on record some new facts if the committee is sort of controlled and sticks to substance and manages not to go off the rails in some Democratic partisan way? Yes, all those things are possible. So at this point, that's her calculation. And really, the only question is how many Republicans want to sign on against Kevin McCarthy's wishes?
Well, but, Maya, no love lost between Jim Jordan and Liz Cheney. It would have been interesting to see that unfold. But briefly, do you want to add anything to what we just heard?
Well, I think also what we're looking at here is Pelosi saying that she really doesn't want to politicize this as much as it has increasingly become a political issue, that indeed people died on January 6th, and that people, particularly voters in 2022, are owed some kind of an explanation for the role that the former president and Republicans have played in stoking tensions ahead of it, which I think plays into why you're seeing this tension now on the Hill. It would be very difficult to include people on this commission who actively played a role in the events leading up to January 6th.
Yeah. Let's move on to another big topic of discussion in Washington, and that's infrastructure. The infrastructure bill faced a setback in the Senate. There was a failed vote that could have begun debate on the spending package. Democrats say that's not the end of this. And then earlier this week, Biden was asked about whether he'd attempt to end or change the filibuster. That could affect whether this infrastructure bill gets a vote or even debate. So, Maya, what are we to think here about the future of this infrastructure bill?
Well, I think Democrats will come away having passed something. There will be another vote probably early next week. But it seems, though, that many, including those on the left, are kind of gritting their teeth and going ahead to support this bill. There's just been a lot of back and forth. Obviously, it's been infrastructure week in Washington now for like the last 3 months. And so there's also just this feeling, I think, among many on the Hill that they have to do something and have something to show for all of these conversations that they've been having. And I don't think it's also, I think it's worth noting here the fact that a lot of these discussions are taking place against the backdrop of crumbling infrastructure in this country. I think just in the last month, we've seen a number of disasters on that front. And so Democrats are also under some pressure here to deliver, not just to show bipartisanship, not just to kind of be all on one accord here and follow the lead of the White House, but also to fix some really immediate problems that they'll have to answer for, especially on the campaign trail next year.
Well, you know, I just want to ask a little more about infrastructure because, you know, Biden has said, you know, he doesn't want to change the filibuster. And as we know, it saw a setback this week because it had that failed vote that would have begun debate on the spending package. That's the filibuster. You know, talk about that insistence on Biden's part. For instance, an example would be voting rights. With the filibuster, it would need 60 votes to pass, but by carving out a civil rights exception to the filibuster, it would just need a simple majority. Biden's loath to do that. He wants bipartisanship. Here he is in an exchange with Don Lemon on a CNN town hall in Cincinnati earlier this week.
So why is protecting the filibuster, is that more important than protecting voting rights, especially for people who fought and died for that?
No, it's not. I want to see the United States Congress, the United States Senate, pass S1 and S4, the John Lewis Act, get them to my desk so I can sign them.
So, Margaret, you know, this is some heat on President Biden.
You know, it is, but honestly, Senators Manchin and Sinema are making it really easy for Biden to take this position, because even if he said, yes, I believe we need to do away with the legislative filibuster in the Senate tomorrow, like, the support inside the Democratic caucus doesn't actually exist to do it. Literally, he can't do it. There's no way to do it. So what you hear Biden talking about is things like he would support the talking filibuster, which is like, you know, if when you learn about the filibuster in school and it's like people stay up all night and they read Green Eggs and Ham, like that is what used to happen. There would be a lot less filibusters if people had to do that again and like couldn't go to the bathroom and had to read a book at 3 a.m. And, you know, so that's where he's focused his effort, I think, because the support to end the filibuster doesn't exist, even if he decided that he wanted to do it. Interestingly, I think on the infrastructure front, I think we still are more likely than not to get some kind of a bipartisan deal out of it. You've seen the Republicans who are part of that bipartisan deal come forward now at the end of the week and say, like, look, oh, by Monday, we actually might have something. This is around $600 billion dollars in new spending. And they know that if they don't pass it, the Democrats are going to tack it on to their budget reconciliation bill anyway. I think if you're in Washington looking at this up close, it's like one of those abstract paintings where it just looks like a bunch of crap thrown on a piece of canvas. But if you take a few steps back, like even this smaller bipartisan deal that they're trying to salvage, it's a lot of money. It's compared to no money. It is a lot of money. And a lot of Republicans are invested in getting at least the beginnings of some infrastructure spending going. So I think we don't know how long exactly this is going to take. It could stumble again on Monday, but they are really, really into the nitty gritty, pulling tax proposals out, replacing it with delaying a Medicare thing that Trump wanted to do that will come up with the money. So there really is an effort right now among that bipartisan group to try to salvage that $1.2 trillion deal, about half of which is new money. And we may see some progress early next week.
Well, let's turn to the pandemic. Nearly half of House Republicans won't answer the question of if they are vaccinated or not. Some Republicans are not only disclosing their vaccination status, though, they're encouraging the public to get the shot. Earlier this week, House Minority Whip Steve Scalise announced he got his, urged Americans to do the same, and here is Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
These shots need to get in everybody's arm as rapidly as possible, or we're going to be back in a situation in the fall that we don't yearn for, that we went through last year.
So I wonder, Maya, do you think that at this point these kind of conservative voices could sway Americans who right now are not willing to get the vaccine?
You know, I think about that, and I see lawmakers talking about this finally on the right who are weighing in on getting the shot. And I also think about the fact that Fox News and more conservative media are finally also starting to weigh in. And I find that to be one of the more effective tools here, because that's where a lot of the folks who have been reticent to get the shot, members of Trump's base who listened to him when he originally said that COVID was a hoax, and also kind of stoked a lot of tension and just insecurity around the shot. I think the same people who elevated that, a lot of the outlets that sort of gave voice to that, should also be those that are weighing in on this or elevating the the counter.
Right. Maya King covers politics for Politico. Margaret Taleb is managing editor for politics at Axios. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks
Liz.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can.
Everybody sing. Jackson Browne's super hit from the 70s, Doctor My Eyes, one of his many songs that would hang in the air like a musical question mark. He's sold over 18 million records in the U.S., been inducted into both the Rock and Roll and the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Rolling Stone calls him one of the greatest songwriters of all time. And now he has new pieces, a new album called Downhill from Everywhere. And you might ask how he's doing. Well, here's the opening track, Still Looking for Something.
I'm still looking for something. I'm out here under the streetlight, baby. I'm still looking for something in the night. I might be giving up something. You don't get something for nothing, baby. Nothing you can hold up to the light. If all I find is
still questioning. Still looking for something from Jackson Browne's new album, Downhill from Everywhere. Jackson Browne, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
We have to ask first, how are you? Because you were one of the first to announce you tested positive for COVID back in March 2020. How bad was it?
Yeah, I didn't have it that bad, actually. And I knew that. I didn't mean to announce it. I don't really usually alert the media if I'm sick. It's like, it just happened to come up in conversation with someone from Rolling Stone. I was about to release these two singles because I was going to go on the road with James Taylor, and it just came up.
But also, I mean, it's just underscored, even though we feel like maybe some of these songs could have been written during a pandemic with the questions that they have and the urgency that they have, these songs were before the pandemic.
Yeah. Yeah, they're all written before the pandemic. And I touched a couple of them up during that time where we were shut down and couldn't work. But no, they were on subjects that I was immersed in for, you know, several years before making a record.
Well, some could say you've been immersed forever in some of these issues, you know, questions about social justice, about the environment. Let's listen to another song. This is A Human Touch, which you co-wrote with Steve McEwen and Leslie Mendelson, and sing it with Mendelson. Let's listen. Again, Jackson Browne, written before the pandemic, you could fib a little and say, no, I wrote this inspired by the fact that everybody was lonely.
Yeah. What we did in that song is it's both about a specific moment in time and about a specific issue, which is the beginnings of the AIDS epidemic. It was for a film called 5B. So it had to be about that film and about that experience, but also it was certainly about the broader issue of where you find love and who people love, and the important part is that you love. So the broader meaning certainly gets heightened, you know, during a thing like the pandemic.
It is kind of a pandemic song, just about AIDS. I want to play one of my favorite songs of all time. Tom Rush's version, Turn Me to a Pillar of Salt. Drake recorded it. Here's your These Days.
I don't do that much talking these days. These days. These days I seem to think a lot about the things that I forgot to do. And all the times I had the chance to.
So Jackson Brown, you said you wrote this when you were about 16.
Yeah.
And you're questioning the things you forgot to do and all the time you had a chance to do it. You were 16. Talk about that sense of yourself even then, or maybe those are just lyrics that sounded good together for you, but was there something you seemed to be born with that had this sense of urgency or time?
What you just said really is probably more like it, just fitting words together that sound good. And
don't say that.
No, believe it. There's way, you can't sing stuff that isn't true. And for whatever reason, I wrote those lines. I was immersed in, you know, an emotion and a self-reflective moment in time, and maybe discovering for the first time your own fallibility. But I think that people underestimate how intense, you know, young people's emotional life is.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was listening to Dr. My Eyes and I smiled because you have the lines, it's later than it seems, just tell me, is it too late for me? And I'm thinking, you're 23. In the new songs, we have lyrics like, time is slipping away, time like a river, time like a train. We're here but for a moment. Talk a little bit about just your sense of urgency now.
Yeah, there's the personal part about it, about being, you know, at old and seeing that you only have a certain amount of time left. But there's also the recognition that we, even when we're young, we're really only here for a while. And then there are the fact that the world is in crisis. The world is in crisis ecologically, economically, politically, you know. The world we're leaving to future generations is really in question. There are really deep questions that have to be answered right away.
Well, let's listen to the title song from the album Downhill from Everywhere, inspired by oceanographer Charles Moore, who said the ocean was downhill from everywhere. It's true. Let's listen. Jackson Brown, you know, environmental causes have long been important to you. So are social justice issues, and I'm thinking of this past year with a reckoning. How do you sing about things like that after 60 years without saying, listen to me?
It's a question of how to be most authentic. I mean, I could compare myself with some of my heroes, some of the greats, and say, like Kris Kristofferson, with his incredibly iconic and undeniably American voice, can start a song with, well, they're killing babies in the name of freedom. We've been down this sorry road before. I never think of being that direct, but he can do it. It's a question of how to be most authentic. You want to put this in a way in which people will, in which you will persuade. You want to persuade people to see things the way you see them. And so sometimes you strategize too much and you're kind of oblique. Sometimes you're too direct and you people feel that they're being lectured.
Yeah.
being able to describe the world in terms that you recognize, to be able to reveal a truth to yourself and perhaps reveal something to your listeners, that's the coin of the realm, you know?
Yeah. You mentioned touring with James Taylor. What is it like to perform with him?
He's such a master, and he's such a long-standing part of all of our lives. It's a thrill to get to share a stage with him. I'm one of those people who's there to hear him too, you know? This is the funny thing. Arnold McCullough is James's harmony singer, and I use his app. He's got a singing app.
What does a singing app do?
It's called Vocal Ease, and it's him leading you in these exercises. I can say is that it really works. Like, I wish. I always wanted to sing better than I can sing, and that goes for right now. But anyway, it all got sort of moved in a very real way when I started using this app. The real teacher, though, the real singing teacher, is singing for an audience. That's when you're really hearing yourself sing and hearing it with fresh ears. It makes a huge difference.
It sounds like what you're saying is live and learn. Okay, so now there's an app. Well, you have it. You wish you had it before. Now you have it. I mean, there is just benefit to years spent doing something. I mean, there's something to be said for that ease.
Well, it's funny you said you're talking about that. Apps, you know, like I say in one of my new songs, you know, there are no directions, you know, there ain't no app, you know. I mean, you can sign up for courses, or you can, you know, like you can get Arnold's app, for instance, you know, but I mean, in the end, it's your own desire to get somewhere, to answer the questions, and it's really the questions that are yours.
As we said, that's where we started. Jackson Browne, the new album is Downhill from Everywhere. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ron.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
Today, the Biden administration announced plans to help homeowners avoid foreclosure, just as another federal housing program is set to expire. That's the CDC's moratorium on evictions. It ends August 1st. But this new aid could help some people with federally backed mortgages reduce their monthly payments. For more, we're joined by Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Mike, people I know, many, are on the edge of their seats here. So what exactly is this Biden administration offering borrowers?
Well, like you said, Robin, it applies to mortgages that are backed by the federal government. I mean, the government plays a huge role in sort of insuring mortgages so that if people can't keep the payments up, then the government comes in and pays the payments for them. So what this program, in light of that, is able to do is offer a variety of ways for people with certain government-backed loans to reduce their monthly payments by upwards of 25% by modifying the terms of the loan. In other words, lowering their interest rates and or also extending the terms of the loan so that the borrowers have a longer time to pay back.
So Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, I mean, those federally backed home loans, but who can qualify? Can you just be struggling a little bit, or do you have to really be about to teeter? Who qualifies?
Right. So in this case today, it is loans backed by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Veterans Affairs. And you're right, you have to sort of go through the paperwork and apply and show to them that you are struggling to make the payments to be qualified.
Yeah. And how can borrowers find out what options are available to them?
It's pretty complicated, Robin. So I think the best thing to do is to contact the servicer of your mortgage directly. In other words, that's the company who you write a check to each month or have an automatic withdrawal program set up with through your bank. So if you reach out to them, they will walk you through everything you need to do to qualify for these.
Yeah, so there's been many short-term extensions this administration has implemented, you know, to try to prevent foreclosures and evictions. How do these plans compare?
Well, you pointed out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They are sort of the big heavyweights in the mortgage industry as far as government backing for loans. So one of the goals of this program announced today was to bring the loans that are backed by HUD and the VA and the USDA into sort of the same scenario that the Fannie and Freddie loans are in. So it's a sort of a way to stopgap and make sure that everyone with a federally backed loan is able to get the support they need.
Okay, so this is an add-on kind of. Do you think it's enough?
I think it's hard. It's hard to ever look at something like this and say if it's a cure-all or a panacea. But I do think it takes a big step to making sure that all those gaps are filled and that no one gets left behind who needs the aid if they're still struggling from the ramifications of the virus.
Yeah, and as we know, Joe Biden was vice president during the 2008 and 2009 financial crisis, the frightening housing collapse. Do you think that is influencing his policies?
You know, I wouldn't want to put words in his mouth, but like you said, he played a huge role in the government response to the financial crisis. And what that crisis really highlighted was how important the mortgage industry is to the entire U.S. economy. So I think, yeah, I would guess that he is taking a lot of those lessons learned back then and applying them to this situation here, because the threat to the mortgage industry and the ripple effects to the rest of the economy and just to people's lives if they get their house foreclosed on is just as bad as it was then.
Mike Regan, Senior Editor, Bloomberg News, thank you.
Stacey Abrams likes to fix problems. It's why she founded Fair Fight to combat voter suppression in Georgia after she lost the governor's race in 2018. And her organization ultimately played a big role in flipping that state to Democrats in the 2020 election. Now, Republicans across the country are proposing legislation that would make it even harder for people to vote. But Abrams is not done fighting. She told podcast host Aarti Shahani that efforts to protect the ballot never really stop. You have to keep fighting.
There is a naivete that says, oh, we've gotten this done and therefore we can march forward in victory. No, victory is incredibly temporary. Loss is temporary. And so the third lesson is to recognize that what I did in 18 led me to understand what needs to be done in 20. And what we got done in 20 created a whole new set of issues for 21. And so you can't ever believe that what you've done is enough to defeat those who oppose you.
Shahani recently spoke with Abrams on her podcast, Art of Power, which explores how people view the role of power in the world. And Aarti Shahani joins us now. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
One of the things that struck me immediately in your conversation was in a discussion of perfectionism, because frankly, who does more things than Stacey Abrams?
Right? She's a Renaissance woman. Exactly.
She's a TV producer. She writes romance novels in her spare time.
She writes leadership books. She runs organizations. Exactly. Right.
Yeah. So, and yet she does not see herself as an overachiever. What did she say?
It's just so interesting. I would actually clarify, she may see herself as an overachiever, but not a perfectionist. And it might actually be that not being one enables her to be the other. A point she made in our interview is she aims for A minus B plus. She's not trying to get everything perfect, because there is actually a cost to doing that. You know, when you're really striving for everything is just right, well, that's time you're not putting into other stuff. And so actually part of how you can explain, I mean, besides the fact that she's just incredibly intelligent and hardworking, you can't take that away, but there is a mindset there. And it's one that I think that I particularly was affected by, because it's like, you know, the conversation with her makes me ask, Aarti, if you weren't so worried about being imperfect, how much more would you let yourself do? And so part of what Stacey Abrams does is she embodies that, how full a woman you can be.
you talked quite a bit about losing, right? Failure. Specifically when she lost the race for governor in Georgia. Yeah. She lost to Brian Kemp in 2018. And this is a point that she's talked about quite a bit. I mean, in some ways, you would think Stacey Abrams at this point has thought about it so much, she's kind of an expert on loss. Mm-hmm. What did you learn from her?
The loss, it's not actually as she describes it. It's not due to anything on her own part that went faulty. You know, she had this machine that was diligently working, doing that door knocking, doing that really unglamorous work of organizing. But she just didn't anticipate just how powerful her opposition in the form of then Secretary of State Brian Kemp, the man running against her and also controlling the machinery of voting, she didn't anticipate how effective he was at, in her view, removing people from the rolls. You know, yes, she turned out, you know, 1.9 million voters showed up for her on election day, but he managed to toss out 1.5 million voters from the rolls. And how much easier it is when you're in a position of authority to axe people from the project of democracy, how much easier it is to do that than to bring people into democracy, to convince them to participate. I mean, it's really a tough fight. There's no such thing as a decisive victory. You win some, you lose some, you get up, you keep going. If you expect to just win and call it a day, you're going to be disappointed because history rarely hands you that. And her point then about viewing the work of democracy as ongoing, where the victories are only temporary. It also means the defeats are only temporary. To me, that was very sobering.
I mean, one thing you realize as you listen to a number of interviews with Stacey Abrams is how kind of honest she is and straightforward.
Yeah, seriously. It is weird for a public official to be so forthright.
It really is. It really is. And I wanted to play one of the comments she makes about voting, because when you think Stacey Abrams, you think voting advocate, right? Mm-hmm. But she also, when she spoke to you, was quite honest about the limitations of voting. Let's listen.
Voting isn't magic. Voting is medicine. And so my work is to not only make sure you get the healthcare you need, meaning you have access to the right to vote, but it's also convincing you that it's worth taking the medicine because things do get better incrementally. Mm. Ploddingly, and we may never cure the disease, but if we can treat the symptoms, things will get better. There is progress. But we've got to be honest about that.
How does she think that message plays with people who are cynical about voting? That's a nuanced message.
It is. And you know, she made the point to me that people are not indifferent. A lot of people are not registered to vote. It means that they don't believe. They don't have faith that this is really going to change something. And that's actually not so different from how we are when we're supposed to take a certain medicine and we just stop because we don't really think it's going to cure the disease, right? And so I think the analogy is very apt. And so much of her work then on the ground, as she describes it, has been to convince people, you matter, and we're going to tackle issues that you care about, right? And it is. I said this a little bit before, but I want to kind of emphasize this. There is a very big play she's got going on that is not the typical political play. Typically, people running in politics are not looking at, oh, how do I get the unlikely voters to come in and join me? It's how do I get the middle to fall to my side? And the middle is actually quite small. The unactivated is much larger. And so she's made that bet. She's made that bet.
You didn't just talk about politics, for sure. Mm-mm. I mean, you mentioned...
Nope. We did not just do that.
You mentioned her romance novels. She sees them as a way for her to experience things she may never get to in her life, right? Mm-hmm. Let's hear a little bit of her talking about that.
I've not been great at dating. Hmm. And I, you know, after a while, you realize some of it's them and some of it's you. Hmm. I think I could get better at it. I just have to practice. But I have friends who are just sort of innately, they think about love in this wonderfully kind and inclusive and soft way that I'm just not capable of. Mm. I think I'm a good partner. I think I'm a good person. Mm-hmm. But I sometimes forget the easy sort of soft things.
I mean, that honesty, it'll just get you every time. What
from
is
such a public figure.
Yeah, right? It's surprising. I wonder what you took away from this part of the conversation.
She opened the door to a discussion of her romantic life. She referred to, as we were talking to each other, the fact that she's not much of a romantic. And
yet writes romance novels.
And, you know, something I had observed in interviews of her and profiles of her prior to our conversation was that she seems to leave the door open. She seems to be ready, willing, and able to talk about that aspect of her life, maybe perhaps more than we are able to absorb it, to be curious, to open that door ourselves. You know, that's an interesting thing about being interviewed is there's what you're willing to offer and there's what the other person is willing to take in. And if so much of her public voice has been immersed in the political field and sort of, you know, into a discussion of partisan politics, that field doesn't leave so much space for the woman, right?
Yeah.
And she is one, fully one. You know, it's not so different from when she publicly said that she was interested in being President Biden's, at that point, candidate Biden's running mate as vice president. She just put it out there. Yeah, I'm interested. It's boldness, right? To say what you have to offer, to say what you're working on, to say what you need. It's an interesting act of vulnerability that I don't see that often in public figures.
Aarti Shahani, host of the WBEZ podcast Art of Power, talking with us about her interview with democracy activist Stacey Abrams. Aarti, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tune into Fox News this week, and you'll likely hear a public service announcement. Now picture big Fox News names like Steve Doocy, John Roberts, Dana Perino.
It was a challenge unprecedented.
And so many rose to the occasion.
Now, with the end in sight, we hope.
We have to keep up the fight.
Wear a mask, distance where possible, and if you can, get the vaccine.
America, we're in this together.
Fox News host Dana Perino, Steve Doocy, Harris Faulkner, John Roberts encouraging their viewers to get vaccinated. A turnabout for a network that still features vaccine skeptics or outright conspiracy theorists on air. Notice some of the biggest Fox names who've been spreading disinformation are not there. But what's driving this new and sometimes conflicting message? What impact could it have? NPR media correspondent David Folkenflicht is here. David, why, first of all, do you think we're seeing this new messaging from Fox?
Well, you know, I hear the word turnabout. It strikes me more like a roundabout. I think Fox has had, in some ways, more of them than you'd find in the carousel in Central Park up here in New York City. It's you are seeing a more concerted effort to have people, significant figures at Fox, explicitly talk about the value of the vaccines, particularly in this PSA. I think there was one earlier in the year as well about, you know, the importance of the vaccine, health safety, and other things. But, you know, I wouldn't say it's totally reflected in what we're seeing in their programming. And you're having moments where Steve Doocy, for example, got in a push and pull with his co-host Brian Kilmeade earlier this week about it. And he said, look, it saves mm-hmm. lives. It's very clear. You saw Sean Hannity saying, hey, look, it's important. Vaccines work. Talk to your doctor. But it's often surrounded by a lot of anger at public health officials, who are in sense trying to get out the same message and perhaps doing it a little bit more sternly. I think all of it has to be viewed in light of the strong surge in particularly in red states where vaccination levels just simply aren't as high, and Fox is being pressured on that.
Well, you mentioned Sean Hannity. Now, we should say Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham are not on board. They've criticized the COVID vaccines just this week. But then there's Sean Hannity. In March, he called the virus a hoax. This Monday, he told his viewers, take the virus seriously. He said this.
And it absolutely makes sense for many Americans to get vaccinated. I believe in science. I believe in the science of vaccination.
But then last night, he played that down.
I never told anyone to get a vaccine. I've been very clear. I am simply not qualified. I am not a medical doctor. I know nothing about your medical history or your current medical condition.
And David, it strikes us, you know, Sean Hannity still has enormous influence, but it's being dwarfed by Tucker Carlson's. And so what do you make? I mean, is there some internal fighting over what the message is or what viewers are telling these hosts they want the message to be?
Well, I think you've hit on something very important, just as with the question of whether or not Joe Biden's win in November was legitimate. And it was. A lot of core Fox viewers and a lot of core Trump supporters, who are often the same folks, don't want to hear this from the Biden administration, don't want to have these limitations on, and don't trust what public health officials often, even in their state and local jurisdictions, are telling them. And so in some ways, Fox has been following their audience on that. For Tucker Carlson, who has spent so much time trying to take down former President Trump's critics, you know, it is seemingly a reflexive reaction to take down those who are pushing a harder line on this than the former president did. You know, Sean Hannity, you know, has seemingly straddled both sides on this, but he hasn't been the worst of the bunch. I got to say, Tucker Carlson and Ingram, as you've suggested, have really gone out of their way to play up every possible instance that could cast a concern about a vaccine. When you're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of people being vaccinated across the world, you know, A, you're going to have a certain number of instances crop up, and B, the proof that there hasn't been widespread problems with these ones that we're using in America suggests they actually are quite safe.
Well, this is also happening within this organization, which had been seen as a mouthpiece, for instance, for the Trump administration, certainly leans right as the virus is ripping through red states. Now, some GOP lawmakers are also changing their tune. Representative Steve Scalise, the House number two Republican, posted a picture of himself getting a dose this week, months after he was eligible for one. So how is that affecting this political calculus since the Delta variant is hitting red states harder? Do you think there could be a broader shift across the board in how both lawmakers and talk show hosts talk about this?
I think you're seeing it's almost like three steps forward, three steps back in some ways. You are seeing some conservative government officials, governors, lawmakers saying, look, this is an incredibly important thing and we have to get level of vaccinations up. And then you're seeing sort of this mealy-mouth stuff. You know, from Hannity, he's basically saying, I'm not against the vaccines. I agree with them generally. Talk to your doctor. But it's really stopped short from urging. You know, the reason public health works is because there is, I got to say, a message based on the best facts that we have in front of us that this is a necessary thing to do. And Fox right now is both doing that through the public service announcements we heard at the top of this segment and not in terms of what they're showing with a lot of their top-rated hosts.
Yeah. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
And we'll keep following the messaging. Meanwhile, Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Celeste Headlee. It's Here and Now.